But when they recommenced in 1945, the old structures were still there. The Conservative Party, which had only been out of government for a total of about 3 of the previous 30 years, was forced into opposition and to a rethink of its political programme and its internal organisation. But it was recognisably the same party, and in Churchill, it had a leader of world renown. Decisive in the election of 1945 were the memories of the Depression that had seared public consciousness in Britain. There could be no return to those dismal years. Demand for major social and economic reform to prevent a recurrence of such misery had unseated Winston Churchill and swept Labour to power in elections in July 1945, with over 60% of parliamentary seats. The new government under Clement Attlee, the entirely uncharismatic but highly effective new Prime Minister, set out to build Jerusalem here and now in England's green and pleasant land, as William Blake's early 19th century poem had expressed it. Attlee was supported by a number of highly experienced and competent ministers. Among the most prominent was Ernest Bevin, who in the interwar years had been the most powerful trade union leader in Britain. Bevin was a massive presence as Minister for Labour in the wartime government, and now, in one of Attlee's masterstrokes, he was made Foreign Secretary. Another key figure was his near namesake, Aneurin Bevin. A former miner and powerful orator, Bevin was deeply marked by the deprivation and hardship suffered by Welsh mining communities, and under Attlee, he became Health Minister. The ascetic Sir Stafford Cripps, a former left-wing rebel in the party whose earlier enthusiasm for Stalin had worn off during his wartime stay in Moscow as British ambassador, and given way to a new liking for management, efficiency and New Deal-style planning within a mixed economy, was especially influential in directing Britain's post-war economy. Nothing less than a social and economic revolution through democratic means was the aim of the new Labour government. Coal mining, the railways, gas and electricity and the Bank of England were nationalised. Under the Education Act, introduced by the wartime coalition government in 1944, wider access to secondary schools became available. Workers' rights were improved. An extensive housing programme was undertaken. Above all, the welfare state, a term that has been aptly described as the talisman of a better post-war Britain, and the crowning achievement of the Attlee government, was established. Family allowances, paid directly to mothers, were a universal provision, and a raft of welfare legislation implementing much of Lord Beveridge's scheme for social security, laid out in 1942, started to reduce the worst of pre-war deprivation. The greatest achievement in most people's eyes, then and in later decades, was the foundation in 1948 of a National Health Service, chiefly the work of the inspirational Aneurin Bevin, and hotly opposed by the medical profession, which provided treatment without the patient having to pay directly, beyond, of course, the contribution through taxation. The result was a substantial improvement in health provision for the poorer sections of society, and a reduction in deaths from pneumonia, diphtheria, and tuberculosis. These were major and enduring advances. For those who lived through the immediate post-war years in Britain, however, there was another side to the coin: austerity. Britain was victorious but poor. It had huge debts to pay off. Its defence costs were still those of a big imperial power, and the much-needed and greatly welcomed social reforms meant higher state expenditure on welfare. For Britain to pay its way, exports had to be increased, imports drastically reduced. The result was a long continuation of wartime constraints on consumer spending. Welfare reforms eliminated the worst deprivation. Even so, For the great mass of the population, daily life was hard, drab, and lacking in material comforts. Most staple foodstuffs were still rationed. The war had been fought and won without bread being rationed, but in 1946 bread rations were imposed and lasted for 2 years. I sometimes wonder who did win this war, the comment of a housewife in northern England in 1946 probably reflected a widespread sentiment. Many commodities were unavailable. Whenever and wherever supplies of some sort were said to have arrived, queues formed. Women especially had to find time to queue, sometimes for hours and often without success. My Auntie Gladys joined a long queue in Oldham, hearing that nylon stockings were available. Finally, nearing the front, she learnt that there were no nylons after all. People were queuing for tripe. "Well, I'm not queuing so long for nothing. I'll have some tripe then," she said. Food rationing only ended in 1954, long after rationing had been terminated in other parts of Western Europe. Only then could children obtain sweets without ration coupons. And only once petrol rationing ended could those with cars find enough petrol to drive them any distance. Tolerance for the austerity, widely present at first, gradually wore thin. By 1950, some of its former voters were ready to desert Labour. The Conservatives were on the verge of regaining power. Whatever the party political divisions, however, the welfare reforms introduced by Labour were broadly supported by all parties, in contrast to economic changes, nationalisation of industries and other policies. The Conservatives recognised that there could be no return to the politics of the 1930s. They accepted the need for change and adapted well to it, thereby introducing a period of remarkable consensus on the essentials of social policy that would last for more than 2 decades. Labour's reforming momentum sagged after 1948, and its hold on power lasted only a total of 5 years. But it indelibly changed the country during that time. Britain's path had continued under Labour to diverge from that of continental Europe. The country's pronounced sense of separateness from a Europe that had twice within living memory drawn it into World War, and its identification of interests with the Commonwealth and its wartime ally, the United States of America, would continue to exert a powerful hold on British political culture for years to come. In most of Western Europe, the hour of the left quickly passed. One reason for this was that its own divisions were again soon laid bare. Anti-fascism alone was insufficient to hold the left together. The old fissures inevitably opened up anew, between, on the one hand, socialist parties committed to change within a pluralist democratic framework and ready to work with a reformed and controlled capitalism, and on the other, communist parties wedded to Moscow, working for the destruction of capitalism altogether and an exclusive hold on power in the state. A second reason was the emergence of the most important new political force after the war, Christian democracy. This revitalized conservatism was wholly supportive of pluralist democracy. It proved able to widen the electoral base of the old confessional parties, integrating previously splintered social and political interests not just negatively through anti-communism, but positively through its backing for substantial social reforms. Conservative elites before the war had generally tried to block change and had often obstructed democracy, which they had seen as a threat to their interests. Following the war, a new political elite untarnished by fascist associations took a different approach. It saw the need to incorporate social change and to welcome parliamentary democracy, which it sought to bend to its own interests. As a consequence, large swathes of each country where socialism or communism had barely, if at all, penetrated, lay open to the appeal of conservative but reformist politics that embraced social change within the framework of Christian principles. The third and overriding reason, underlying both the weakening of communism and growing division of the left, as well as the emerging strength of Christian democracy and other forms of conservatism, was the deepening split between Eastern and Western Europe that soon hardened into the Cold War. This proved the most important factor of all. The more the unsavory aspects of extended communist power in Eastern Europe became apparent, the easier it was for West European conservative parties to play upon long-standing antipathies towards the Soviet Union and fears of communism at home. Political allegiance in much of Western Europe, in essence, split rapidly in three ways: between socialism, communism, and Christian democracy. As antagonism between the Western Allies and the Soviet Union deepened, divisions on the left hardened, support for communism declined, and the Christian Democrats gained ground. The left found itself increasingly unable to shape the political agenda. This, with variations, was the trend in Belgium, Luxembourg, Austria, Italy, France, and West Germany. In the Netherlands, the Catholic People's Party retained a more narrow confessional basis than the new Christian Democrats in other countries. The distinctive political and cultural pillars that had marked Dutch society before the war, socialist, Catholic and Protestant, with a looser liberal conservative grouping, largely reconstituted themselves in only slightly differing form. The political framework in Belgium, too, was a case of modified restoration. The dominant forces were conservative. As the middle class and rural population proved the main beneficiaries of a reformed capitalist economy, while the radical left lost appeal among the industrial working class. In Austria, under four-power occupation but treated as a liberated country, the Communist Party was a negligible force from the outset. Though it was allowed to join a grand coalition government, dominated by the new-style Christian Democratic Austrian People's Party and the Social Democrats. The outright priority was to establish national unity rather than renew pre-war divisions. Italy's future seemed in 1945 likely to be determined by the revolutionary left. But amid continuing grave economic problems, before the end of the year, the Christian Democrats, headed by Alcide De Gasperi, a former prominent member of the Catholic Popolari, were emerging as the most important new force in Italian politics. Italian Christian democracy blended a highly conservative wing with leftist sectors that included Catholic trade unionists. But De Gasperi proved a master of manipulating both wings of the party to retain control. He was helped in the early stages by the willingness of the communist leader Palmiro Togliatti, who had spent the war years in Moscow, to take the communists into government. De Gasperi's government, a seemingly unlikely coalition of Christian Democrats, communists and socialists, effectively ended the purges, replaced many of the recently appointed police chiefs and regional prefects with long-standing experienced officials, took big firms out of the hands of the commissars who had been running them, and put them back in private ownership, and began the restoration of public order. The coalition was confirmed in office in elections on the 2nd of June 1946, at the same time that the electorate rejected the badly tarnished monarchy, and turned Italy into a republic. The three-way split in Italian politics was set to continue. Together, the socialists and communists formed the largest sector of popular support. But they were divided in policy objectives as well as in their base of support. Moreover, the left's support was heavily confined to the industrialized regions of northern Italy. The more rural parts of the country mostly backed the Christian Democrats, the clear winners with over a third of the total vote. In May 1947, the incipient Cold War led to tensions within the government that proved insuperable and led to the expulsion of the communists. In the parliamentary elections of April 1948, held under the shadow of a red threat, the combined vote of the communists and socialists fell from 40% in 1946 to 31%. Pope Pius XII had told Italians that anyone supporting an anti-Christian party was a traitor. American anti-communist propaganda also proved highly effective. The Christian Democrats were able to increase their vote from 35 to 48.5%, and with that, attain a majority in the Chamber of Deputies. The transformation from the revolutionary violence of the partisans to a governmental majority of conservative Christian democracy had been remarkable. The split on the left meant that the Christian Democrats could manage, despite their own internal divisions, to retain control of an unstable political system for years to come. France was the only country in Western Europe where the communists, with 26%, attained a higher vote than the socialists, 24%, at the first post-war elections. The new political force, however, was the Mouvement Républicain Populaire, Popular Republican Movement, or MRP, the French variant of Christian democracy, which won 25% of the legislative elections on the 21st of October 1945. Following the election, the MRP, together with the Socialists and Communists, the main forces of the resistance, formed part of a tripartite alliance. A provisional government with a mandate to devise a constitution for a fourth republic. Charles de Gaulle, who had already formed a provisional government of the Liberation on the 25th of August 1944, continued as the head of this government. The MRP could profit from the part played in the resistance by some of its leaders, such as Georges Bidault. Like other Christian democratic parties, it managed to combine an appeal to a left rooted in Catholic social thinking with a more traditional conservative body of support. The MRP played a part in most governments throughout the Fourth Republic between 1946 and 1958. But unlike Christian democracy in much of Western Europe, within a few years its support withered rather than grew. The influence of the Catholic Church on politics was far smaller in France than, for example, in Italy or West Germany. But the gradual failure of the MRP was largely because, unlike other Christian democratic parties, it faced a major challenge on the conservative right, one that materialized in 1947 and was spearheaded by no less a figure than the outstanding French war hero Charles de Gaulle. The MRP had in fact been open at first to working together with the socialists and communists to bring about far-reaching social reform, and it supported the fostering of good relations with the Soviet Union. Each of the parties favoured greatly widened welfare provision and extensive nationalisation, including banks, insurance companies, coal mines, electricity and gas production, airlines, and the Renault car manufacturers. De Gaulle, despite his ingrained conservatism, accepted the move to state ownership and a planned economy. Masterminded by Jean Monnet, an experienced economics expert empowered to oversee the measures needed to modernize the French economy and restore production. The French New Deal began to take shape with massive political backing. Trade unions, often dominated by communists, the Communist Party itself, the Socialists and MRP played their part in ensuring high levels of industrial productivity, encouraging farmers to bring about rapid expansion in food supplies to the towns, and introducing better social security, pensions, maternity benefits, and other improvements to the lives of ordinary people. But the changes needed time to take effect. Living standards, undermined by high inflation and shortages of food and many basic commodities, remained low for at least 2 years following the liberation. Political conflict naturally grew. The impact on the government's popularity was predictable. The continuing difficulties, mounting political disillusionment, and the return to the usual divisions and conflicts of party politics in a pluralist system didn't sit well with de Gaulle's lofty vision of himself at the pinnacle of a unified France. In January 1946, he suddenly resigned as head of the provisional government. He resurfaced in June to argue vehemently for an elected president with executive powers. There were no prizes for guessing who that should be. The electorate disagreed and voted instead, if in lukewarm fashion, with a third of voters not bothering to cast their ballot, for a fourth republic in which parliamentary powers outweighed those of the executive. The result was a system that would replicate many of the disadvantages of the pre-war Third Republic. By strengthening the powers of the legislature, elected through proportional representation, to dismiss the government, which invariably represented an uneasy coalition of conflicting political interests, the new constitution ensured continuing political instability. De Gaulle, contemptuous of the new constitutional arrangements, announced in April 1947 that he intended to form and lead a new political movement, which he called the Rassemblement du Peuple Français, Rally of the French People, or RPF. Within a year, his party, supposedly standing above conventional party politics and built on a platform of nationalist unity, anti-communism, and strong executive power vested in a president, was making inroads on the political right. It gained 500,000 members, mostly from the middle class and peasantry, and up to 35% of the vote in a number of municipal elections in northern France, though the breakthrough at the national level remained elusive. The tripartite government coalition was, however, creaking. The socialist prime minister, Paul Ramadier, took advantage of a wave of strikes by communist-dominated trade unions in April 1947 and communist opposition to the government's use of force to uphold French imperialist rule in Madagascar and Indochina to dismiss communist ministers. Tripartite government was over. The communists wouldn't participate in government again for more than 3 decades. The MRP, the socialists, radicals, and smaller parties were left to form a series of unstable governments, somewhat pretentiously depicted as a third force, but held together by little more than their hostility to both communist and Gaullist opposition. By the early 1950s, support for the MRP was crumbling, as the French conservative right failed to overcome its division. Weak governments were set to remain the pattern for the remainder of the Fourth Republic. The western zones of occupied Germany were the pivotal arena of Europe's political reawakening. The reconstruction of the political landscape began remarkably quickly after German capitulation. Already in its foundation message in June 1945, the Christian Democratic Union, CDU in Berlin, appealed to Germans to unite all their efforts in rebuilding the homeland. The Social Democrats, SPD, and even the Communists, if in different ways, also made national unity the center point of their immediate attempts to garner support for starting the recovery. Both left and right saw the need to widen their basis of support and to overcome the crippling divisions that had poisoned politics during the Weimar Republic and paved the way for Hitler's triumph in 1933. The Nazi Party, on its way to power, had largely destroyed the old bourgeois, liberal and conservative parties, except for the Catholic Centre Party, while the socialists and communists had continued their disastrous internecine conflict that stretched back to the revolution of 1918 and its aftermath. 12 long, bitter years of dictatorship and brutal persecution of opponents had then followed. What is striking about the immediate post-war years, however, isn't just how quickly pluralistic politics recommenced, but how far the patterns of political support at first mirrored those of the Weimar years, and how far they were still determined, not just by social class, but by religious allegiance. The Christian Democrats rapidly built a basis of support on the conservative right that went far towards overcoming the debilitating divisions of the Weimar era. They saw themselves as a party that stood above class and confession, embodying the spirit of Christian renewal to overcome the criminality of the Nazi past and to combat the godless forces of the world still in existence. They looked to a society that combined democracy with social justice in a fundamentally reformed capitalism built on Christian principles. Already in 1946-47, the Christian Democrats frequently emerged as the largest party in regional and local elections in Germany's western zones, gaining over 50% in parts of the south, usually more than 30% further north. The man who would become the party's first leader and the towering figure in German Christian democracy for almost two decades was Konrad Adenauer, by this time already almost 70 years old. Before Hitler's takeover of power, he had been Lord Mayor of Cologne and was subsequently imprisoned on two occasions during the Third Reich. He was strongly rooted in Rhineland Catholicism, fervently anti-communist, and in favour of reconciliation with the West. As the Cold War became an inescapable reality from 1947 onwards, Adenauer moved the CDU away from its early leanings towards a substantial reform of capitalism in the direction of a liberal market economy. The party became more well-disposed towards big business, promoted especially by its economics guru Ludwig Erhard, though its program continued to blunt the effects of the worst inequalities of free market capitalism by social welfare measures. The move to the right allowed the CDU to find a measure of common ground with the emerging smaller Free Democratic Party, FDP, which was built on principles of economic as well as individual freedom, strongly pro-business, and opposed to all notions of nationalisation. In the first national elections of 1949, the FDP gained 12% of the vote, the SPD 29%, with the CDU narrowly ahead on 31%. The FDP's 12% proved crucial in enabling the CDU and its Bavarian sister party, the more conservative Christian Social Union, heavily Catholic in its values, to provide the mainstay of a coalition government under Adenauer as federal chancellor. While the conservative right was discovering new unity, the left was returning to division. Social Democrats and communists had joined together in the Antifas, anti-fascist committees that had sprung up in German industrial cities and big factories in 1945 in the common fight against the dying Nazi regime. But no sooner was the war over than the victorious Western allies disbanded the Antifas, seeing them less as constructive components in a new society than as a threat to order and an opening for communism. It was an early indication that the Allies were determined to block any radical alternative to a reversion to pluralistic, liberal conservative democracy. It seems unlikely, in fact, that the Antifas could have provided a lasting basis for political reconstruction, but they weren't given any opportunity. That accorded with the mood of the great majority of the German population, who wanted change but had little appetite for revolutionary experiments. The Communist Party was unable to break out of its earlier strongholds in the industrial working class. Even before the Cold War set in and almost completely undermined its support, the average vote for the communists in the Western zones was under 10%, a third of the SPD's average level of support. The SPD was itself committed to radical social and economic change. Its leader, Kurt Schumacher, whose moral authority derived from 10 years in Nazi concentration camps, stood for the early restoration of German national unity, though one built firmly on democratic principles and a new economic order. He advocated the nationalization of major industries and the redistribution of farmland to be expropriated from big estates. But Schumacher was vehemently anti-communist. He blamed the communists as well as the Nazi-supported middle classes for the disaster of 1933, and he increasingly feared that the Communist Party would open the door to Soviet dominance in Germany. However, his own rhetoric of class struggle predictably failed to win over the large tracts of conservative Germany. The 1949 election to the federal parliament, Bundestag, was contested by a wide range of political parties. The political landscape was still taking shape, but its main contours, a threefold division between Christian, free, and social democrats, were already becoming clear. In Eastern Europe, including the eastern zone of Germany, the political landscape had taken a fundamentally different shape from the outset, long before the Cold War became set in stone. The Western Allies certainly exerted their own controls over the rebuilding of politics in their zones, often favouring conservatives over social democrats, for example. But their level of intervention was in a minor key compared with that of the Soviets in areas of Europe under their domination. Pluralist politics crushed in Eastern Europe. If at first the Soviets had been more uncertain than later seemed the case about the strategic development of the eastern zone of Germany, they increasingly paid only lip service to pluralistic democracy. There was at first the appearance of pluralism. Liberal and conservative, as well as socialist and communist parties, were established. But the pressure in favour of the Communist Party was overt and relentless. Walter Ulbricht and other communist leaders who had spent the Nazi era exiled in Moscow set out to ensure a firm base of communist power, rapidly taking over crucial administrative positions. Nationalisation of industry, redistribution of expropriated land, and purges of economic, administrative and professional elites proved predictably popular among those who possessed neither property nor wealth. But it became clear in local elections over the winter of 1945-46 that, despite their advantages, the communists had far less support than the social democrats, and that they couldn't win a democratic majority through the polls. By February 1946, the communists were pressing to merge the two parties. Schumacher passionately led the SPD's opposition. Ruth Andreas Friedrich, a former journalist, for long active in the resistance to Hitler's regime and now a fervent supporter of the SPD, was clear about the danger. For 9 months, she confided to her diary on the 14th of January, German communism has been the recipient of orders from Moscow. If we put our head in this noose, not only are we ourselves lost, Berlin and the whole of East Germany are lost too. Lost for democracy, won for the national Bolshevik claim to world power. The left split. People who a year ago had helped each other against the terror of the Gestapo had risked their lives for the life of someone else, attack each other today like the bitterest enemies, Andreas Friedrich observed. In March, a referendum was held in the western sectors of Berlin, though prohibited in the eastern sector, and over 80% of SPD members rejected the merger. Against violence, threats and propaganda, the will to self-determination triumphed, noted Andreas Friedrich. Nevertheless, in April 1946, a forced merger of both major parties of the left took place in the Soviet zone to create the Socialist Unity Party of Germany, SED. The new party was, from the start, under communist dominance, and it was seen as the main vehicle for imposing the Marxist-Leninist version of democratic centralism on the Eastern Zone. Even now, with all the pressure it could exert, the SED failed to win an absolute majority of the votes in any of the regional elections in October 1946. But by this time, the political arteries were hardening. The vestiges of genuine pluralism were gradually but systematically being eliminated. Those who opposed the transformation to a people's democracy were dismissed from their positions and many of them imprisoned. The process of political and social separation from the Western zones continued, by now irreversibly. By January 1949, the SED was formally proclaimed to be a Marxist-Leninist party, and a German variant of Stalinist dictatorship had been established. What happened in the Eastern Zone of Germany ran parallel to the way Soviet domination was established over most of Eastern Europe in the immediate post-war years. Soviet power wasn't the only factor that determined the political constellation. The discrediting of pre-war elites on account of their collaboration with the Nazis, the levels of support for native communist parties, expectations of benefiting from a redistribution of wealth, and mounting distrust of the Western allies all played a part. But Soviet power was the constant in the equation, the common factor and single most important determinant. And, as in Eastern Germany, the pattern was one of intensified pressure to ensure communist dominance. Once it was obvious that democratic pluralism wouldn't yield the necessary support for communist rule. Hungary provided the clearest demonstration. A multi-party provisional government had won popularity by redistributing to the peasantry land sequestered from estate owners, leading to the mainly peasant smallholder party gaining as much as 57% of the vote in elections in November 1945, whereas only 17% of voters supported the communists. This didn't, however, prevent the gradual destruction of the smallholder party and other forms of political opposition through the communists' brutal, intimidatory tactics, until by 1949 the Communist Party, with Moscow behind it, had complete power in its hands. In Poland, the Moscow-backed Lublin Committee had already by the end of 1944 been given official Soviet recognition as Poland's provisional government, and communists took control of the police and security apparatus. The national government, exiled in London since the beginning of the war, though still recognized as Poland's legitimate government by the Western Allies, was powerless. But the Allies were keen to resolve the problem of Poland. In late June 1945, a few of its members, including Stanisław Mikołajczyk, who had served as its prime minister, were persuaded by Western leaders to join a more broadly constituted provisional government of national unity, with the prospect of elections to follow. With that, already before the Potsdam conference the following month, the Allies bowed to the fait accompli in Poland, informally withdrawing their recognition of the government in exile in London. At Yalta in February 1945, Stalin had promised democratic elections, but his version of democracy wasn't that of the Western powers. When the elections finally took place in Poland in January 1947, it was in the context of heavy Soviet repression and intimidation. Over 100 opponents of the communists were murdered, tens of thousands imprisoned, and many oppositional candidates disqualified. Officially, the Communist Bloc won 80% of the votes. What the true vote might have been in genuinely free elections is impossible to know. The Western powers looked on impotently, unable to affect the deepening grip of Soviet control. Poles themselves asked, not unreasonably, what the war had been about. They had thought it had been to preserve Polish independence. A similar pattern of communist infiltration of the governing apparatus, intimidation, arrest and imprisonment of political opponents, and rigging of elections backed by Soviet military and security forces characterized the pattern of the communist takeover of power in Romania and Bulgaria. Czechoslovakia was a different matter, and what happened there sent shockwaves through the West, though some policymakers in Washington claimed to have seen it coming. In unquestionably free elections in May 1946, Soviet as well as American troops had withdrawn beforehand, the communists won the largest proportion of votes, 38.6%, giving them a degree of democratic legitimacy. Their success wasn't surprising. There was enormous social distress, huge levels of poverty, widespread homelessness, and vast economic disruption. The years of German occupation had, as elsewhere, also left much recrimination and resentment in their wake. Among the reasons why people turned to the communists, there was undoubtedly, especially among the educated, much idealism, a fervent belief in communism as the eternal ideal of humanity, and a national road to socialism that would subordinate individual interests to the good of all society. This, at any rate, was how Hedda Margolius Kovály later put it, a Jewish woman who has suffered grievously in German concentration camps and the wife of a communist minister in the Czech government, who was to be executed in 1952 on trumped-up charges of anti-state conspiracy. Nevertheless, though the largest party, the communists still had only minority support, and even less backing in Slovakia than in the Czech lands. The new prime minister, Klement Gottwald, a long-standing Stalinist stalwart, newly returned from a wartime exile in Moscow, faced widespread opposition, even if from a range of parties divided among themselves. The popularity of the communist-dominated government waned in 1947, as economic difficulties mounted, as the issue of relative autonomy for the Slovaks remained unresolved, and as the country was pressurized by Stalin to reject American economic aid, thereby being forced into the emergent Soviet bloc in Eastern Europe. The communists had reluctantly conceded new elections to be held in May 1948. Their prospects of increasing their vote were poor. But when a number of non-communist ministers foolishly resigned from the coalition government in February, in protest at communist measures to extend control over the police, it triggered a full-scale political crisis. The communists organized mass demonstrations of support for their demands. The pressure on all waverers mounted. The foreign minister, Jan Masaryk, son of the first president of Czechoslovakia, was found dead on the pavement below his office window. A case of suicide, according to the official version, but most people thought he had been murdered by agents of the regime. Nothing less than a communist coup was underway. The elections in May were controlled entirely by the communists, who dominated the new parliament. The hapless president, Edvard Beneš, was compelled to appoint a new government, still under Gottwald as prime minister, but now completely dominated by communists. In June 1948, Gottwald replaced the ailing Beneš as president. Early enthusiasm, where it genuinely existed, soon evaporated. Within months, as Hedda Margolius Kovály saw it, the Soviet Union had become our model, and the rule of law was precarious. Huge repression of opponents followed as thousands disappeared into prisons and camps. A Soviet-style system was now in place in the only country in Central Europe where pluralist democracy had survived before the war until it had been undermined by Western appeasement policy and then devoured by Hitler. It was the definitive confirmation that Stalinism was incompatible with the establishment of Western-style democracy anywhere in the Soviet sphere of influence. Only in Yugoslavia did attempts to extend Soviet influence fail. But here, quite special circumstances prevailed. Tito's partisans had already controlled most of Yugoslavia by the time the Red Army arrived in autumn 1944. Soviet troops withdrew again by the end of the war, leaving Tito to bask in the glory of being the liberator of Yugoslavia. Moreover, the Yugoslav communists, led by Tito, had come to power unaided by Moscow, apart from Albania's, the only communist party in Europe to have done so. Although he had earlier been a loyal agent of the Soviet Union, Tito's stature gave him a secure base of autonomous power that enabled him to defy Stalin's pressure to fall in line with Moscow's demands as the Cold War started to grip. The Soviet dictator's bullying cut no ice with Tito, secure in his Balkan stronghold and enjoying extensive popular support from across a country in which he personally symbolized a new unity that transcended the traditional ethnic divides. Short of invasion, which would have been a risky venture, there was nothing that Stalin could do. In June 1948, the split between Moscow and Belgrade became official with the expulsion of the Yugoslavian Communist Party from the Cominform, the successor organization to the Comintern. Stalin's enmity was barely constrained. The Soviets and their satellites imposed an economic boycott to try to starve Yugoslavia into submission. It was to no avail. Tito, despite constant heavy vilification from Moscow, continued to steer an independent path. In the Soviet Union itself, people felt that the immense sacrifices couldn't be in vain. But the universal joy that had greeted the triumph in 1945 soon gave way to enormous disillusionment. Hopes that victory in the Great Patriotic War would bring a more relaxed political climate were rapidly dispelled. Instead, the Stalinist system tightened its hold. The repressive machinery cranked up once more. The leaders of the Soviet Union, Stalin more than any of them, saw great dangers ahead. There had been many Soviet collaborators with the Nazi occupiers. Millions of new citizens had to be turned into communist believers. Large expanses of newly won territory had to be incorporated. And the threat of capitalist imperialism still loomed large. Moreover, the country had to be rebuilt. Overcoming the colossal material losses meant renewed intensive programs to produce rapid industrial growth. Progress was impressive. By 1947, Soviet industry was, it was claimed, again matching pre-war output. The heavy price was a further decline in living standards, already woeful. Big strikes and demonstrations took place in defense factories in the Urals and Siberia in the autumn of 1945. The secret police registered over 500,000 letters of protest at living conditions. Poor harvests in 1945 and 1946 exacerbated the problems of agricultural production, which lagged far behind pre-war output for years to come. Famine, taking the lives of 2 million people, once more befell Ukraine and other regions of the Soviet Union. About 100 million Soviet citizens suffered from malnutrition. For Stalin and the Soviet leadership, the hardship had to be endured if the Soviet state were to survive, recover, and rebuild its defenses. All potential for unrest, every sign of conceivable opposition, had to be ruthlessly crushed. A new wave of arrests, purges, and show trials, reminiscent of the terror of the 1930s, coursed through the Soviet Union and its satellites in Eastern Europe. Former prisoners of war, suspected dissidents, intellectuals, and minority ethnic groups, not least Jews, were particular targets. Before long, Soviet camps and penal colonies once again held as many as 5 million prisoners. Far from creating a new society in the Soviet Union, the war had strengthened the old. The heavy hand of repression couldn't be even slightly lifted. Stalinism, in all its horror, continued unabated in the immediate post-war years. By 1947, ice was forming on the Cold War. The divisions, a largely monolithic Soviet bloc confronted by an increasingly anxious but resolute American-dominated Western bloc, were already by that time becoming firmly entrenched. By the following year, they were rigidly fixed. Could they have been avoided? Could the revitalization of politics in Western Europe, if not in the East, have taken a different course? In both cases, it seems highly unlikely. Ultimately, the mutual distrust, fear of communist advance on the one hand, fear of aggressive capitalist imperialism on the other, was too deep to prevent Europe from splitting into two halves. Stalinist policy in Eastern Europe was, to be sure, less uniform and predetermined at the start than it often appears in retrospect. Even so, what was plain from the outset was that no alternative to communist dominance would be permitted. The vagaries of pluralist politics in the Western style couldn't be risked. Once it was plain that communist parties weren't going to win power through genuinely open elections, intimidation, infiltration, and pressure to ensure their domination by other means were inevitable. But that could only deepen the separation from the parts of the continent that hadn't fallen under Soviet influence. Crucially, communist parties were nowhere popular enough to come near to winning majority support in free elections in Western Europe. And as communist methods of gaining power in Eastern Europe, looked on aghast by most people in Western Europe, became easy targets for condemnation by anti-communist political parties and by the Western allies, support for communism in most of Western Europe started to recede still further. The division, quickly widening, was unavoidable. It had been there from the beginning in 1945, caused in the first instance by the Soviet need for a protective buffer zone of satellites under communist rule, and could only widen as the international antagonism between the major powers itself took on a defining form. It was cemented in 1947 when Stalin turned his back on the offer of American aid to rebuild Europe, insisting that Eastern Europe went its own way and under Soviet domination. In Western Europe, the scope for radical economic policies became even more limited as the Cold War set in. The fear of communism extending a hold in the West was, not least in the pivotal country of Germany, a significant added ingredient in the backing of the occupying Western allies, especially the Americans, for conservative politics and for a liberalized economy. The chances of a different political course in Western Europe to that which was in fact taken were consequently negligible from the outset. Europe's political reawakening after 1945 is unthinkable from the international context that shaped it. The search for blame in starting the Cold War is largely pointless. It couldn't have been avoided. The division of the continent was an ineluctable consequence of the Second World War and the conquest of Europe by the ideologically and politically antagonistic new superpowers, the USA and the Soviet Union. The Iron Curtain descends. Winston Churchill is usually credited with the graphic image of an iron curtain dividing Europe, which he voiced in a famous speech at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, in March 1946. In fact, Hitler's propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, had already a year earlier referred publicly and privately to an iron curtain in describing the Soviet occupation of Romania. Hitler and Goebbels had repeatedly, in the last months of the war, forecast the breakup of the Allied coalition of Anglo-American and Soviet forces. What they refused to see was that the aim of destroying Nazi Germany was precisely what held the wartime alliance together. Once that aim was accomplished, the dissolution of an alliance comprising such inherently antagonistic elements was as good as unstoppable. It didn't take place immediately in one decisive rupture, but gradually, over a period of 3 years or so, and in a number of decisive cumulative stages. But from the summer of 1945 onwards, it went only in one direction, towards the division of Europe. After the First World War, the American president, Woodrow Wilson, had joined the leaders of Britain and France in determining the post-war order. Russia, convulsed by revolution and civil war, and regarded with mounting horror by the Western powers, had played no part. The USA had soon afterwards chosen not to join the League of Nations and withdrew from direct involvement in European affairs. The contrast with 1945 was stark. After the Second World War, the once great European powers were too weak, militarily and economically, to shape a new order. France was beset by its own internal problems. Its economy was racked by severe inflation, flight of capital and low levels of production. Britain's financial plight was only rescued by a sizable American and Canadian loan in 1946. A sign of Britain's economic weakness was the beginning of its withdrawal from empire. India, the much-vaunted jewel in the crown of the empire, was granted independence in 1947. In another move with huge far-reaching consequences, Britain withdrew from its troublesome mandate in Palestine, leading to the foundation of the State of Israel in 1948. France, more reluctant to relinquish its overseas possessions, was meanwhile involved in an increasingly bitter colonial war in Indochina with Ho Chi Minh's forces in northern Vietnam, which already in 1945 had claimed to represent an independent, democratic republic of Vietnam. That, too, would later have momentous consequences. The First World War had preserved and even extended the colonial empires of the European great powers. A Second World War inaugurated their end. The age of imperial conquest was over. The United States and the Soviet Union stepped into the vacuum left in Europe by the demise of the European great powers. Germany destroyed, France and Britain hugely enfeebled. The two remaining world powers were immensely strengthened in different ways by the war. The USA's economic might now massively outstripped that of any other country. Its military-industrial complex was formidable. The USSR had, in contrast, suffered immense economic losses in bearing the brunt of the Continental War for years, but had built a colossal military machine that gloried in the great victory it had attained and now bestrode practically the whole of Eastern Europe. Soviet military strength far surpassed that of the Western Allies. Even by 1947, after wartime military strength had been drastically reduced, the Soviet army still had around 2.8 million personnel at combat readiness. American forces in Europe had fallen to under 300,000 within a year of the war ending. The wartime conferences of the Big Three, Britain was still allowed the vanity of belonging to this exclusive club, had revealed the dominance of the emerging superpowers. So had the Foundation in San Francisco on the 24th of October 1945 of the United Nations Organization. Foreseen as a more dynamic body than the defunct League of Nations had proved to be, it initially comprised the 50 member states who had signed the Charter on the 26th of June, fewer than a third of them European,